When I arrived at my sister's house, the first call I made was to the police. There was no answer at the Arizona police station at that hour. I got their voicemail, but the Utah police answered. I asked if anyone would be willing to help a woman and her children leave the FLDS community. The police said they had no jurisdiction, because even though we were just a mile or so across the border, we were legally in Arizona. I tried calling a group that assists women fleeing polygamy. No one there could act immediately. I felt the trap closing as midnight approached. My sister and I called my brother in Salt Lake City. Arthur had left the sect 4 years earlier to marry the woman he loved, who was also his stepsister. He was home when I called. I said, "Arthur, if I do it tonight, I can get out. Will you help me?" "Carolyn," he said, "I'll do everything I can to help you, but even if I leave right now, the soonest I can be there is 5 in the morning. Will you do it?" I tried not to sound as desperate as I felt. We were 300 miles away. He would have to drive all night. "I'll be there," he said. We agreed to meet at Canaan Corners, a convenience store 3 miles from town on the Utah side of the border. Arthur said he'd bring a trailer to drive my van back to Salt Lake City. The 9 of us could fit in Arthur's SUV, and he said he'd ask our brother Daryl to drive down too. I told Arthur my van was almost out of gas, but I'd do everything I could to get there. "If I don't show up, come looking for me," I said. "I may have no way out of town, but please don't leave without me." Now I needed to figure out what to tell my children to get them out of the house and into my van. They would never leave if they knew we were fleeing the community. It was just after midnight when I left my sister Linda's house. It was quiet when I returned home. I took 2 black garbage bags from the kitchen and then quietly slipped into my children's rooms to collect clothing, a 2-day supply for each. Since I was often up late at night doing laundry, no one would be suspicious if I was spotted carrying my children's clothing from room to room. I carefully loaded the children's clothing, our family pictures, and Harrison's medications into my van. At 4 a.m., I started getting everybody up. I was very matter-of-fact when I awakened each of my children. I said Harrison was sick and needed to go to the doctor. This was completely plausible. Harrison went to doctors a lot. The younger children thought this would be a great adventure. They didn't get to leave the community very often. I told the older children that since Arthur was home, everyone had to come with me so we could take family pictures afterward at Sears. My older children were annoyed. They didn't want to come. I insisted. One of Merrill's other wives walked in as my daughter Betty was getting dressed. She was suspicious and started questioning Betty. She then apparently called my husband and reported that I was up and dressing my children. One by one, I put my children in the van and told them to buckle their seatbelts. Harrison was the only one left. He was almost 4 and profoundly handicapped, unable to walk or talk and still in diapers. I ran inside, turned off his oxygen, and grabbed him from his crib. I strapped him into his car seat, turned on the ignition, and counted to see if my children were all there. My daughter Betty was missing. I had seconds to decide. Do I leave one behind to save 7? No. It had to be all or nothing. I ran inside and found Betty crying and furious in her room. "Mother, there is something you're doing that's wrong. Why doesn't Father know what you're doing?" I grabbed her arm. She fought back, struggling to break free. I pulled hard. "Betty, I'm not leaving you behind. You are coming with me." She kept screaming. I got her into the van, slammed the door, and started the engine. One phone call from Merrill to the local police and we'd be trapped.